2, 1, go. Careful. What are you doing? Are you okay?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Power Drifting, the Rally Game Podcast. My name is Tom and I'm joined once again here in the virtual cockpit by Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Tom.
How are you?
Yeah, not too bad.
This time, Mike, we are leaving behind the warm, fuzzy comforts of arcade rally racing and embarking on a punishing simulation-based trip through the British countryside with 1999's PlayStation and PC rally title, Mobile One Rally Championship. Are you ready to get very deep in the simulation?
I certainly am.
Okay, let's get this show on the road. Okay then, so this one, a bit of a diversion from the games we've covered recently, just because this is squarely planted in the simulation side of things. This game, Mobile One Rally Championship, was released in December 1999 on the PC and on the Sony PlayStation, February 2000. It's always interesting looking back at these games, Mike, you know, these older games from this kind of period, because they always have like really weird publisher and developer relationships that have gone on, because and in different regions they're always released by a different team or developed by a different developer, and this game is not different. So the PC version was developed by Magnetic Fields and published by Europress. The PlayStation version was actually developed by a company called HotGen, who were almost like a sort of a porting house, who did ports of like big name console franchises to the Game Boy Color, as much as I can tell anyway.
Okay.
And it was published by Actualize in Europe and Electronic Arts, weirdly, in the US. The US not a market, you know, that is traditionally associated with rally simulations. But yeah, this game has got quite the lineage, shall we say. It's not really a series as you would generally expect a series to run, but it does have quite a lineage. And I know, Mike, you were a PC gamer around this time, so I'm sure you've got some experience with some of the games I'm going to mention in a second. But before I do, do you have memories of this game from the time of release?
I do indeed, yeah. So I've got my big box PC version still on my shelf.
Excellent. Is that the big orange box? The big orange box?
It is bright. You can see it from about 2 miles away. It's really good. I think I picked it up in a vague memory of picking up in a local game store, pretty much at the time of release. Just as I was getting into sort of rally games, I played a couple of rally games from the sort of the last, I'd say last gen of games. Obviously, it doesn't mean a thing on PC gaming, but sort of the Network QRC rally games. And then Rally Championship was something, so it was really good. It got really good reviews. And I happened to be on the PC Gamer forums at the time, and it got really, really good publicity. So I picked it up, absolutely loved it.
Excellent stuff. Yeah, you did mention the Network Q. The whole series, the whole kind of unofficial or official, if you want to look at it that way, series of these games runs in this order. So the first game was a Lombard RAC Rally in 1988, which was then followed by Network Q RAC Rally in 93. Followed by Network Q RAC Rally Championship, there's a theme developing here, in 1996. Then came International Rally Championship in 1997, which is interesting because that game was actually released on the PlayStation in the UK as Tommy Mäkinen Rally. I didn't know that until I started doing this research. I just assumed that they were completely different games. I didn't realise that it was just a rebranding of that game. Which is odd. Then Mobile One Rally Championship, this game that we discussed on this podcast, came in 1999. And then that was followed by Rally Championship Extreme, which I have played and is terrible, in my opinion. That came in 2001. And the final game in this whole series was just titled Rally Championship, and that came in 2002. And I do have that one on the PlayStation 2, so maybe we'll cover that in a future episode or on a bonus stage episode. But that is the full rundown of the games in this series. But the last one to be developed by this developer, Magnetic Fields, was, in fact, Mobile One Rally Championship. As the name suggests, It's based on the British Rally Championship and on the 1999 season. And I don't know, Mike, seems like a lifetime ago now, doesn't it? 1999. Obviously, there's another big release in that year in the name of the in the name of the Sega Dreamcast. But we won't talk about that on this podcast. Not now, anyway.
I feel like I spend most of my time in 1999 trying to relive the past. To be honest, Tom.
So. Yeah, it's like locked in a sort of a time warp when when times were good and games were games magazines ruled supreme. And you're just like, oh, look at that! Look at the screenshots in this magazine. Amazing, God, those were the days, eh? Those were the days when you used to like read a letter in a magazine and on the letters page with somebody that you disagreed with, and you'd like furiously handwrite a letter and send it off to the magazine in response to the letter in issue, blah blah blah. Such and such said this. I disagree.
And I completely agree. And in actual fact, to tie this back to the game, I actually did write the letter of the month in PC Gamer in 1998, and I won a force feedback steering wheel, which I used. For Rally Championship.
That is the best segue ever, mate. Superb. Of course you did. Of course you did, Mike. I wouldn't expect anything less. So, 1999, the halcyon era in gaming. British Rally Championship was at the height of its popularity. And this game kind of came out and just kind of propelled it into everybody's mindset just because of the fact that it was so damn good. We'll get onto that in a minute. Let's talk first of all about the game itself. Let's talk about gameplay modes. As with any racing game, you've got standard options to play with. You've got your time attack. You've got your arcade mode, which is against four other vehicles, and then you've got your standard championship, where you take it in sequence to go around the different rallies of the British Rally Championship, accumulate points, fix your car, that kind of thing. We'll come on to that in a sec. The PlayStation version has a split-screen two-player mode. The PC does as well, but it also has a network player mode, multiplayer mode. Did you ever play that, Mike, the network mode?
I have a funny feeling I probably did, yeah. I think I played, this was about the time I played online gaming a lot on PC. I think I have a couple of memories of playing one or two races online. I think, though, that it was probably a little bit slow, or my internet connection was a little bit slow at the time.
It would have been dial-up then, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Rally Championship, then, it features 36 courses from around the British Isles and features a total of six different rallies. And they are the Vauxhall Rally of Wales, the Pirelli International Rally, which is in the Kielder Forest of Northumberland, the RSAC Scottish Rally, the SEAT Jim Clark Memorial Rally, which is in Scotland, the Stenaline Ulster Rally, and the Manx International Rally. Now, the interesting thing about this game is that every single course is accurately mapped down to the meter, because they used ordnance survey maps and actual photography and video from the courses to basically. It's almost like they did a Metropolis Street Racer before Metropolis Street Racer. So they went to the courses, the developers, they went on the courses, they drove the courses, they recorded everything, and then they turned each course with the corresponding ordnance survey map into possibly the most accurate rally simulation of the era, really. There are over 420 miles of course in this game, and that is evident in the way that some of the courses take about 15 minutes to complete, if not longer in some cases. And, when you are somebody who has come from mainly playing sort of arcade rally games, if you were to sit down in front of this game and then start a course, and 15 minutes later you're still on the same course, I could see how that may have turned some people off. Do you know what I mean? Even in the sort of the press of the time, there was a strong. It was almost like trying to drum into people: this is a simulation. It's a simulation. It's not an arcade racer, even though it has an arcade mode, weirdly. It's a simulation. If you want accuracy and you want to see stats and accurate topography and how long it actually takes to complete a rally course, this is the game for you. I can imagine a lot of people possibly bought this game, installed it on their PC, started playing it, or played it in the PlayStation, and were just completely turned off by how long and... I hate to use the word, but sometimes laborious some of the courses can be to kind of get through. Do you know what I mean?
I think definitely PS1 players probably more. Sort of maybe defining a game as a bit of a not necessarily fair to PS1 gamers, but I think on PC there was still, or there still is now, there is still a large community of sim players. So I think the game went down well with them, and I think it appealed to them. I don't think there's so many people on a PC. If you're a PC gamer back in 1999, 2000, I think you expected a more serious experience.
Yeah.
But definitely there was, you know, Colin McRae had come out. Colin McRae 2 out at this point. I can't remember what year Colin McRae 2 came out now. But it was all sort of, you know, Colin McRae was had redefined what rally gaming was. V-Rally had done the same thing. So I think that this was, I'm sure for PS1 gamers, some of them would have had a bit of a surprise when they go through a 21-minute or 19-minute mountain stage in Wales. You know, and literally, and, you know, this is well before the time of instant rewinds. You know, this is,
oh, yeah.
This is a 21-minute track, and then the very last corner, you run off and hit a tree. It's punishing. It can be punishing, and it certainly scratches that simulation itch. I don't think many rally games, even now, there's not a huge amount of simulation rally games, is there?
No, you're right. Yeah, and it's interesting you touch on Colin McRae Rally there as well, because that was literally like the yardstick on console at the time.
Yeah,
obviously you had things like Sega Rally, but as sort of a step above the a complete arcade experience of Sega Rally, if you wanted a bit more depth, then Colin McRae Rally was the thing to go to. Again, maybe a bit of V-Rally in there as well, but to have this game on the PlayStation, I would hazard a guess that a lot of gamers who weren't necessarily into simulation-style rallying were possibly burnt by this. They may have seen it on the shelf and gone, oh, I've played Colin McRae Rally, I like that, I'll get this, and then been completely turned off by it because it's not what they were expecting on a console.
Yeah.
Fair play to Magnetic Fields for putting this out on the PlayStation, but I just don't think it. I just don't think it really works on the PlayStation. We'll talk about that in a little bit anyway. But before we do, we'll just get down into the sort of the meat of this game. 30 right. The game has three different classes of vehicle initially available to you when you start. And the final class, which is the WRC class, is opened once you sort of prove yourself with these initial vehicles. And they are separated into if you're not familiar with the British Rally Championship, the classification of vehicle is slightly different to what you get in the WRC. And they are this. So you start with the A5 class, which consists of the Ford Puma and the Nissan Micra Maxi. You've then got the A6 vehicles, which includes the Skoda Felicia, the Proton Compact, the Honda Civic, Citroen Saxo, and the Peugeot 106 Maxi. Then moving on, you've got the A7 cars. So you've got the Nissan Almera, the Ford Escort, the Skoda Octavia, Ford Escort Maxi, Vauxhall Astra, Hyundai Coupe Evo 2, Volkswagen Golf, Renault Megane, and the Seat Ibiza Cupra Sport. If you complete the championships in all of those different categories, you then move on to the WRC, which in this game is known as the A8 class. So you've got the Mitsubishi Lancer Evo, the Proton, Huayra or Persona. My dad used to have one of those. I've mentioned that in a previous episode, but you did. Seat Cordoba, WRC, the Mitsubishi Lancer Evo, Evo 5, the Subaru Impreza, and the Peugeot 206 WRC. So quite a nice mix of vehicles there. And it's interesting playing a game like this now, today, because when you play games like WRC 9, the even though you've got a lot of different teams to choose from, the choice of cars is actually quite limited because a lot of the teams all use the same vehicles.
Sure.
So it's nice to see different types of car represented, really.
And classic rally cars, aren't they? I think, you know, if you think of a rally car even now, many of those names will still come up. Obviously, the Impreza, obviously. But other cars as well. The Ibiza is the car I drove in this game.
Mm.
The game, I'm sure we'll go into this in a bit more detail, but the game sort of it cries out to play it in the slowest car you can. I'll explain a bit more why I said that for, but it's sort of the game where the most normal road like car is probably the best way of playing a game, in my opinion.
Interesting you mentioned the Seat there as well, because that was the one on the box. The car that kind of leaps out to me the most is the fact that it's got the Renault Megane, which is iconic from that period, you know, the yellow and blue livery. It's just iconic and emblematic of the British rally championship of that period, because that was the winning car in, I think, in 1998 or 2000, one of the years either before or after. It was the Renault Megane that that won the championship. And I knew somebody with a Renault Megane. I'd never seen one in a game before, so I was just kind of like, oh look, there's a Megane. a game. It's not exactly like an exotic vehicle, but I think it's the fact that these cars are not like exotic and, you know, showy. They're just cars that you see on the street. You know, you could, you know, walk past a Skoda Octavia or a Nissan Almera and just go, oh, another one of them. But when you see them in a game with all the liveries and they're all done up, it just sticks in the memory. Some interesting bonus cars as well, Mike. I don't know if you ever unlocked any of these. I certainly didn't. But I found a video on YouTube that shows them all. So I'm going to talk a little bit about them now. One of them is a sheep on wheels. Nice. One of them is a cow on wheels. There's a theme here. One of them is an estate car with a load of sheep attached to the roof, I think it looks like, anyway. I can't really tell from the video. It's quite low quality. But the best ones are these. One of them is an actual house, like just literally like a cottage with wheels.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I remember.
And another one is like a skip. It's just a yellow skip with a driver sat in it on wheels. And just as a side note, I was looking at this, I was thinking, why is it called a skip? People in America who are listening to this probably don't know what I'm talking about, but it's basically one of them big sort of metal containers that you put rubbish into and then you lift onto the back of a truck or a lorry. I did a little bit of Googling into the etymology of why it's called a skip. It's known as, it comes from the old English word skep, which itself comes from the old Norse skepa, meaning basket. And it was first recorded, the first recorded use of it being called a skip, this dates back to the UK in 1922. So there you go, Mike.
Yeah.
Educational as well, this podcast.
Yeah. Sorry. Not only rally podcast, we also go into the word origins of numerous words. next episode, the entire episode is based around word origins of rally terminology.
Mate, that'd be amazing.
That'd be amazing, yeah.
Right. Let's move on to the game itself then. Let's talk about the visuals, the aesthetics. This is one of the main things about this game. This is why it was kind of propelled to the forefront of like magazine covers and everyone was going on, wow, PC gaming is the future. This is one of the games that was held aloft as a showpiece, really, for PC gaming while us pros were playing on our consoles. I did have a Dreamcast at this point, so it wasn't too bad for me. But for the riffraff who had the PlayStations and the Saturns and the N64s, you know, they probably looked at this game and went, "Oh my god, it's mind blowing." The graphics are a major talking point in this game. It still looks pretty good now, to be honest. It doesn't have a lot of the effects of a modern rally game like WRC 9 or Dirt 5, but it still looks decent. So you needed a pretty good PC to play this game. I'm going to go into the specs now, which were recommended in the PC manual. Before we do that, though, Mike, you've got a PC, I've got a PC. I would like to know what specs you are rocking in your PC currently.
God, I don't know. I don't play games on PC that much, so I've got a pretty standard PC. I've got a 8 gig RAM, quad core, AMD something.
Well, I'm disappointed. I thought we were going to get proper geekish there. But for those people who are interested, I've got the i7 4790K at 4 gigahertz. I've got 16 gig of RAM. I've got a GTX 960. You know, lo and behold, this game runs perfectly on my PC. You know, obviously we are here in the year of our Lord 2020, not in 2000. God, it's 20... Still can't get my head around that. It's 20 years ago, this game.
20 years, yeah.
It still looks pretty good. So the minimum specs for this were Windows 95, an Intel Pentium 2 processor at 266 megahertz, or an AMD K6 at 350 megahertz, a whole 64 megabytes of RAM, 20 megabytes of hard drive space, an 8 megabytes PCI graphics card. Oh, and a sound card and a 4-speed CD-ROM drive, if you had those. But the recommended specs, and this is where you're getting to, like, you know, this is wow territory, were Windows 98, an Intel Pentium 3 at 500 megahertz, or an AMD Athlon at 500 megahertz. 128 megabytes of RAM, Mike. 128 megabytes.
Yep.
650 megabytes of hard drive space. A 16 megabyte AGP fast 3D graphics card. hardware-accelerated 3D sound, a 32-speed CD-ROM drive, and, check this out, DirectX 6.1. If you had all those things on your machine, you could basically play this game on the highest settings, and it looked, to my eyes anyway, photorealistic back then.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the key things that made this game so popular, was because it looked so good.
Yeah, I think so. I think from a geographical point of view, someone who's a bit of a geography fan, nerd like me, the game's realism and its graphical quality was definitely one of the big draws for me. I actually had quite a good PC at the time. I'm pretty sure I actually had a recommended specs PC, because actually it was just after I started my first job, and actually my first job then paid for my first thing I bought before I bought a Dreamcast. The first thing I bought was actually a PC. So one of the reasons I bought a PC was probably for this game. That was how into it I was. But the graphics were stunning. I think they were playing it now, and we've had both of us had an issue recently about trying to get this game to work. It's a little bit patchy at times.
Yeah.
But at the time when I played it, the graphics were, obviously at the time you always think something was photorealistic. But the step up from this game, from one of its predecessors, so International Rally Championship is another game where I love the predecessor for this one. And the step up from that to this is a generational leap. It's almost a PS1 to PS2 style leap in quality. And it is just incredibly detailed. I've got an itch when I play a game. I love open world games, and one of the reasons I like to explore. And this game is one of those games where you just want to explore the surroundings, because you want to see, you know, I remember very distinctly climbing a hill in the Isle of Man rally, and there was a phone box at the top of the hill. And for some reason that stuck in my mind ever since, in terms of the fact that I just had this, it's just so detailed, there's this phone box. And if you slow down next to the phone box, you can see the detail they've put into it. And it's really good quality. I don't know if the PS1 version is the same. I'm guessing probably not.
No. It's interesting you mentioned the PS1. That was the next thing I was going to talk about. I think because the PC game was so visually stunning for the time, the downgrade for the PlayStation and its abilities it stands in stark contrast to what the PC game was doing. So it's almost like it looks. It's horrible to say this, but it actually looks bad because of it.
Yeah.
I don't think the PlayStation game even is on a par with something like Colin McRae Rally, because it just isn't. And it's almost like they tried to basically downscale what was being done on the PC, but the PlayStation just couldn't really deal with it. So it just ends up looking a bit of a pixelated mess. That's not to say it's a really bad looking game. It's perfectly functional, but you just don't get the same sort of spectacle. No.
I think we are contractually obliged, though, to say that they put it onto the wrong console. Because if they put it onto another console that was around in late 99, early 2000, it would have looked stunning.
It's funny you mention that, because I was, I'm sure I saw somewhere that this game was being ported to the Dreamcast. And I'd looked high and low through different magazines, and I can't find the actual article that I've actually burned into my memory, into my psyche, where it said that this game was being ported to the Dreamcast. As a kind of a consolation prize, I did try playing the PlayStation version on a Dreamcast using Bleemcast, but I couldn't get it to work simply because it would run. However, the controls are not remappable on the PlayStation. So basically, all the cars in the game have a semi-automatic gearbox. So when you start the game, you need to click into first gear for it to become an automatic gearbox. Because the Dreamcast controller doesn't have an R1 button, you can't click it from neutral into first gear. So basically, you just sit there on the starting grid, revving your engine. I mean,
it'd be interesting to see whether the Brook Converter might actually... we're getting into Dreamcast territory now, aren't we?
Yeah.
The Brook Converter, which obviously allows you to play other controllers, and does recognise other buttons, even though it's not recognised normally for a Dreamcast.
Okay.
So that might... You never know. It might be... We might have found a new game to add to the Dreamcast pantheon of games, which seems to be enlarging by a rapid rate every day at the current time.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I seem to remember trying a PlayStation controller with the Total Control joypad mapper, but because the there was no R1 was just not recognized still, even though it was a PlayStation controller plugged in. So maybe with the Brook controller, yeah, we are going off on a bit of a tangent. People listening to this probably don't even know what a Brook controller is or care. So that's about as close as I got to getting it up on the Dreamcast. One to explore in the future, I think, maybe.
100, right 1, and 2, left 2, and 2, right 1. 100, over right.
Okay, so yeah, we've spoken about how great this game looks and you know, how you needed quite a beefy PC to get it to run properly. But I think any racing game really lives and dies by its control model.
Sure.
Now, playing this game in the modern era, I don't think it plays that well. I think the handling, while it may have been described as uber-realistic back then, I find that the vehicles are very floaty and a little bit lightweight. And I also feel that they actually, it seems like they turn on that sort of a central pivot point, like we've mentioned for a couple of other rally games around this period.
Yeah.
It's actually quite hard to like initiate like a power slide or something like that, because the vehicles just don't want to do that. They want to pivot on a central axis. So playing it from an external view just feels a bit odd, because you're constantly twitching the controller left and right to make the car kind of go left, right, you know, to try and stay on the racing line. Yep. It's not so bad when you're doing it from the internal cockpit view or the bonnet cam, because you can't really see the car moving that in that weird sort of, you know, incremental way every couple of seconds. But it just, yeah, there's something not quite right. I mean, we're probably spoiled now by our modern day brains, where we kind of expect rally games to just play in a certain way.
Yeah.
Back then, you know, obviously Colin McRae existed, but this was squarely in the sort of simulation side of things. And even still, I still don't find it to be that satisfying to play. I don't know what your thoughts are, Mike.
I think, obviously, it's been a while since I've played it, you know, really heavily. I remember playing it with the steering wheel.
Right.
I've tried to have a look, actually, and see if the steering wheel's anything mentioned online about steering wheel's compatibility with the game and how it played with it. But I'm sure I remember playing the game with the steering wheel. I remember it being really, really good. But when I did get it to work about a year ago now, I think it was, when I first mentioned it to you, Tom, and I got it to play at one point. And exactly the same as you, really. I felt it very floaty, not very floaty, actually, that's harsh on the game. I felt it to be not as weighty as I remembered it to be. It reminded me quite a lot of V-Rally in terms of its quite sort of loose and floaty feel, which, again, when I played V-Rally a few years ago, I felt then, I don't remember the game being like this.
Mm.
I think it's maybe just the fact that as the years have gone on, 20 years have gone on, games have realised that racing isn't just about getting from point A to B. It's about that weight. And I think the only game at this era that I really think got the weight down, even Colin McRae feels a little bit floaty to me. The only game which I feel really, really got the weight down was Sega Rally. I think Sega Rally got that feel down perfectly. Mm. So yeah, it does feel a bit floaty. But I think with the steering wheel, I remember being really strong. And when I mentioned earlier on about the fact that the game, I mentioned on the podcast before about the fact that I think rally games and this type of rally game is more about you against nature,
mm-hmm.
And you against the environment. And I think Rally Championship is the greatest exponent I've ever played in terms of really immersing yourself in the world of rallying. These 20-minute stages, these marathon stages, it is properly just delving in there. And I think if you have that mindset, especially at the time, if you had that mindset where it was this sort of like cross-country race and you had to really focus heavily, the controls probably didn't matter a massive amount to us at the time.
Yeah. Now I see what you're saying, yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of the environment. One thing that really kind of struck me with this game is the fact that it's possibly the only game, you know, that's set within the British Isles as a rally game that's not just completely focused on Wales.
Yes.
So it's nice to see some other environments, especially when they look as good as they do in this game. You know, yeah. And that feeling of desolation at points, you know, you are, you know, racing through the Kielder Forest or, you know, on the Ulster stages.
Yes.
You know, there's no crowds. It's just you and a vehicle, you know, going through this quiet forest. And it's not got the razzmatazz of the WRC and or the sort of the over-the-top presentation or production values of like the sort of the American rallies, you know, Travis Pastrana's and the Ken Blocks of the world and Jim Carner and all that stuff. It's just down and dirty, very basic. Here's a saloon car. Here's a forest. Go at it. There's no crowds, you know.
I think I was thinking about this week. I think British-based games have to rely on the game more than spectacle. I think, you know, games, it's very simple, very easy to put, well, I say very easy, I don't make games, but it's very easy to put a racing game and put, you know, racing through the streets of Rio or, you know, going along a sunny beach and stuff. You can do that and it looks spectacular, fantastic. When you have to just rely on British weather and the British landscape, which is actually quite desolate,
yeah,
in areas, you really focus on the game. The reason I said I've thought about it this week is that I replayed for a very short time one of the Manx TT racing games from Milestone, I think, isn't it? The last couple of years. And not Manx TT, the Manx racing games. Well, it is Manx TT, isn't it? And they, yeah, obviously they're based in British tracks as well, obviously the main Isle of Man TT race. And that's had a very similar feel. But also I've been playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Now, I know that might sound a bit of a divergence from a rally game, but Assassin's Creed Valhalla obviously is set in England. And it's very similar in the fact that, you know, you've played past Assassin's Creed games and you're sort of in the exotic landscapes of ancient Egypt, or, you know, you're in the Greek islands and the sun-kissed islands. When you're actually playing a game in an English landscape, they can't necessarily rely on the visual spectacle. And I think with rally games, rally isn't about spectacle. You know what I mean? It's not about, as you said, it's not about the Pastramas and the Blocks of the world. It's not about always having rallycross games where in front of, like, you know, really exotic locations. Rallying is about getting down and dirty and trying to beat Mother Earth to an extent. And I think this game really gets that.
I can think of one example of a game where spectacle is at the top of the tree. And it involves racing against a massive hovercraft through the English countryside, or rather the Scottish, yes, countryside.
That's game, all the rising. Yeah.
So yeah,
but even that though, I mean, even Forza Horizon. I mean, Forza Horizon, which was one set in Britain. Forza Horizon 4.
Four, yeah, yeah.
Even that, I think, you know, it's actually a much, I don't want to say dull, but it's a much duller
subdued
look to the entire
subdued
game. Yeah, subdued look. It's great for us because obviously we know what it looks like and we know we feel at home playing it. But I can imagine for those people who sort of don't live in Britain and sort of are used to sort of racing games where like really spectacular, you know, countryside, or even like sort of, you know, massive mountains you climb up and you're just going over this British stage and the hills are like 10 foot tall. It's a bit, you know, a bit weird.
Yeah, I was playing Forza Horizon 4 about a week ago, and there's a section where you're driving along and there's this like white horse on a hillside.
Yes.
And my girlfriend, she came in and she's from Dorset, and she goes, "Oh, is that Weymouth?" And I was, no, it's Forza Horizon 4, but it looked because there is a white horse on a hill, but it's not the same. It looks nothing like the one in the game, but the whole kind of atmosphere of it looked like just a random British kind of, you know, country lane, yeah, or whatever.
So, exactly, yeah. And we have the same thing. I think, you know, I said when I was playing the game, I felt a lot of the countryside around Forza Horizon 4 felt like the Cotswolds,
right,
where I'm from.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like it was kind of like Cotswold stone houses and stuff. But the same, one of the reasons that we like Rally Championship, or I think we like Rally Championship, we haven't got to the scores yet, but one of the reasons I like the game is because of the fact that you can race around and you can sort of think in the back of your head, I know that place. I've seen something like that. And I think that we don't usually have that many games as a British-based gamer where we can sort of do that, you know. Apart from the fact that every game has London in it, and London is the entire UK,
yeah,
you don't really have a chance to see little bits of old, out of the way. Can't think of the word I'm looking for now, but the provinces of England, as it were, don't really, yeah, see the provincial side of it. And I think this game and the rest of Britain, this game really does that, and it really brings you home.
Yeah, it nails it, basically. And with the Ordnance Survey maps and everything like that, that just kind of adds an extra layer of authenticity over it. You know, the in-game map is literally an Ordnance Survey map, and there's nothing more British than Ordnance Survey.
100, left 2, and 2, right 1.
Let's move on slightly. We've talked about the graphics, we've talked about the handling of the vehicles. One thing we haven't really touched on is just how difficult this game is. It really does put an onus on you to get to grips with, you know, how the cars handle. It is, again, as I say, a simulation. The championship is especially punishing, especially with its time limits on repairs. I know in other rally games, you get this kind of screen in between stages where you have to work on your vehicle, you know, the bodywork, the dampers, the springs, everything like that. Here, it just seems so much more oppressive with the time that it gives you. Everything needs to be perfect, otherwise you just can't race. You know, the damage model is really good and very intricate. And it seems to have more options for things that can actually get damaged than a lot of other games of this type. To my eyes, anyway. Moving back over again to the aesthetic side of things, I think it's got a great sound. This is one of the first games I remember playing where you could actually hear the sound of the gravel hitting the doors as you were playing from an internal cockpit view. And that really stood out to me, just as something that I'd never really encountered before in a game. The pace notes are really well delivered by real-world co-drivers, Derek Ringer, and you've got Claire Mole as well. She's also a real-world, quite successful female co-driver.
Yep.
And the just all round the presentation is just fantastic. I know we spoke about this in the WRC 9 episode, Mike, about the introductions to the different stages and how it would have been nicer if they'd actually put some effort into like sort of describing the courses. I know that they had that in WRC 4, I think was the last time it actually existed in WRC games. But just an introduction to the landscape and the course that you're about to smash your car through. Well, in this game, it goes one above because they actually got a guy called John Horton, who was the manager of the whole event. He was the head of the British Rally Championship at the time, to basically give his opinion and description of the courses before you even get out there and start racing. And I just thought it was a really nice touch to get somebody so sort of intrinsically involved with the British Rally Championship to come in and actually record the voiceovers for the introductions to the different stages. I thought it was a really nice touch, to be honest.
I think that's one of the reasons I think I brought it up in a lot of rally games we've covered. I've always brought up the fact that I don't know why they don't do that real world side a bit more. And I think looking back, it probably is this game which started me on that sort of obsession, because I come to the game from a different perspective than some people. I like the sort of the geography around it. I like the sort of the real world setting around it. I think it's one of those things. It immerses you in the world a bit more, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know, obviously, this is, again, as we've said many times, this is set solely on British rally stages. So there's no Finland. So unfortunately, we can't we can't go for a blast around Finland. However, I did read that in the real world rally, the winner of one of the stages could actually enter the Finnish rally or the last stage of the Finnish rally as a sort of a bonus for winning a stage within the British rally. So weird little link there. Okay, Mike, we've waxed lyrical about this game for a while now. I think it's about time we gave our thoughts about how good we think this is. We do have a review from the time period, but I'll leave that for now. I want your verdict first, Mike, if you don't mind. What are your thoughts? Final thoughts, closing thoughts on Rally Championship.
Yeah, so I think nostalgia can sometimes be a very dangerous pastime. I think looking back at the game objectively, it's maybe not as perfect as I thought it was. However, you know, you also can't change your memories. And for me, the game was really the big push for me in terms of really loving rally games. This is the game which really started my obsession with off-road racing. The attention to detail is extreme. It is one of these games from an era of PC gaming I think has never been matched in any gaming medium since. And I think the game just delivers everything you want from a rally game and does rally the way rally should be done. It's not done with any sort of pretension of being some kind of global spectacle. This is just good old-fashioned man against nature rallying. And so for me, I think even though the game has got some real poor elements to it, I think looking back, you know, the floating is a disappointment. Mm-hmm. I think there is, at the time, the specs were very high. And I think a lot of people played this with a frame rate, which was stuttering, to say the least. even with those foibles, I think that the game is, for me, on a personal level, a formative experience. And so therefore, I give the game a 10 out of 10.
Wow. That is quite unprecedented so far on this podcast. Yeah, that's the highest score yet awarded. I would like to basically echo everything you just said. I didn't actually play it at the time it was released because, I, as I said earlier, I was primarily a console gamer back then. I had the N64 and then a Dreamcast back then. So, you know, I was looking forward to this game being released on the Dreamcast. I did actually play it at a friend's house who had a PC. Everyone had a friend who had a PC. I did see it running on a PC at the time. And, I was quite blown away by it. I mean, most of my contemporary memories of it are from seeing it in magazines and thinking, God, that looks amazing. And then playing it in later life, was not disappointed in how detailed and just how punishing it is and was. And, going back to it now in 2020 with a modern head, as you say, Mike, it's not a perfect game. The controls leave a lot to be desired. But, you know, that's probably because we're spoiled with modern games like Dirt and WRC. So can't really knock it for that. It's a very much of its time. So, yeah, I'm erring on the side of, you know, pretty high score. So I'm going to give it 9 out of 10.
Nice.
So we've got a review from a professional, inverted commas here. This review is from Edge Magazine, issue 78, November 1999. And this is the summary given. So it says, it probably won't appeal to the average arcade racing aficionado. This being hardcore sim territory, there's little evidence of the gameplay structure so well implemented by Codemasters Colin McRae Rally, for example. Yet the game's caliber may end up converting a fair number of players to reality-based racers. Thoroughly absorbing and rarely anything less than thrilling, Rally Championship is a revelation, and the score given is 9 out of 10. So thoroughly deserving there of all the high scores that we've bequeathed unto this game. Interesting additional little Dreamcast-related factoid, Mike, is one of the artists on this game was a guy called Simon Butler, who has since gone on to work on various Dreamcast indie games.
Yes, he has, yeah.
So, it's all intertwined in some way. Yeah. Do with that information what you will.
I think it's also important to mention the fact that magnetic fields will be well known to people who play racing games in the UK. They made the original Amiga versions of the Lotus Challenge race games, I believe.
Yes, they did. Well,
a lot of people in the 1990s, I think it was one of the first experiences of a real type of racing game. So, I think that's really interesting to look back at a firm which was at the very, very top of their game, I think, when it comes to racing games.
Yeah, definitely. Legendary games there. Okay, Mike, that will do it for this episode, I think. If people want to follow us on Twitter, you can do. You can find us at PowerDriftingPod. Find all of our episodes at PowerDriftingPodcast.com. And we're also all over YouTube now. Smash that like button, as the kids say. But you can find all our episodes on YouTube. I'm expecting somebody to go, "Oh, you lazy bastards. Why have you not put video footage of the actual games?" It's because, well, we're not a video channel. This is a podcast. So, you know, a lot of people like to listen to podcasts on YouTube while they're doing something else, maybe doing the ironing or cooking or whatever. So, yeah. Don't look at the screen while it's on YouTube. Just listen. Listen with your ears. Listen with your eyes. Is that the term? I can't remember. Right. I'm going stir crazy here. Mike, let's get out of here. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of Power Drifting. Goodbye.
Goodbye.